Let's just say you were pregnant right now and starting to call local daycares about a spot for an infant this coming spring. You might hear something like this on the other end.
Right now, we are completely full for infants. We actually are not even taking any more on the wait list because the wait list is so lengthy.
It's not just one place that's hard to get into. We called lots of places.
We have some people call and set up tours the minute they find out they're pregnant. I had a family one time tell me that when the doctor told her she was pregnant, the next thing the doctor said, are you going to call your husband first, or are you going to start calling childcare?
I'm Gina Kaufman, and today on KCUR's Central Standard, we're talking about the daycare crunch. Working parents, we want to hear from you. When your kids were born, did the search for quality daycare send you staring out over a waiting list abyss? What did you do about it? How did you manage to go back to work, or did you? 816-235-2888 is the number to call. While you are calling, let's hear from NPR reporter Jessica Diehl. She recently did a story on the scarcity of childcare for All Things Considered. Hi, Jessica.
Hi.
A lot of people talk about the affordability of daycare, but we don't hear quite as much about availability or scarcity. What inspired you to look into that?
So I was on the taking myself as a journalist completely out of the equation. I was 5 years ago now. I was pregnant with my first child, my son, Carrie. And I was maybe 3 months pregnant. It was just when we were starting to tell people and thinking I was being really on the ball, started visiting child care centers around Washington, D.C., where I live, and starting to put applications in. NPR is like the vast majority of employers in the country where they don't provide any child care for employees. So I was out looking for a safe place for my child to go, and I actually got laughed at a few places saying, you've waited way too long at 3 months pregnant. So what you said in your introduction really rings true for me. So I think we put in applications for 15 centers. We didn't get into any of them. So when I did eventually go back to work after my second child. I now have a 4-year-old and a 2-year-old.
Wait, you skipped over some stuff there.
There's a lot to mine there. But just to fast forward a bit, because I don't want to take up all of our time with my personal story, and we can certainly go back and
I'll fill
you in on the details.
But okay.
We ultimately didn't get in anywhere. So just long story short, we went the nanny share route, which is a popular sort of backup option. But when I went back to work, I just said, this was really surprising to me. Like you mentioned, affordability of childcare is in a big, big issue, but one that has quite a bit, I thought, of national recognition. But the scarcity, even if you are willing, you've made the calculus that it is worth it for me to pay this very large amount of money. I've come to terms with that. It's worth it for me to stay in the workforce. Even if you're willing to pay that amount of money, there's just really nowhere for you to go. And I am not an economist by any stretch of the imagination, but I did take an economics 101, and this just didn't seem like a functioning market economy where you just have these lengthy wait lists. You have a demand and a supply not meeting it. So I did a series last year for NPR called Stretched, which looked at issues facing working parents. And this was the one story that really motivated my interest in the whole series. It was the last piece I did. And I talked to people all over the country, all different big cities, small towns, all over the income spectrum. And people are really experiencing this everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, I guess many of our listeners might hear your story and think, well, in Washington, D.C., that's a big city, a cosmopolitan area where maybe people are competing to get into, you know, every kind of kid activity. But this is, as we have explained, this is the case in Kansas City as well. And what did you find out about this question, this baffling question of why supply and demand doesn't take care of it? So many people need this thing, are willing to pay for it. And there's not enough.
So, yeah, and just to put sort of a finer point on that, this was not sort of your gold-plated bilingual Montessoris that you have a lot of like yuppie city dwellers like angling to get in and competing and
yeah, it's not like the one top place.
Right. It was your very, very run-of-the-mill, kind, even kind of grungy but passable. Like, they're licensed. It looks safe enough. I'm going to take a stab at this. Kind of child care centers.
There aren't, like major red flags.
Right. Exactly. So there were wait lists here in D.C. everywhere. And when I, for the series, took a sort of step back and looked at the national picture, I both had sort of the anecdotal. I was interviewing parents all over the country hearing very similar stories to the one I had experienced. But then we also had the data. NPR partnered with the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, with Harvard University. We surveyed over 1,000 working parents and found that more than one third of them found difficulty finding childcare. And also in the course of my research, I found the Center for American Progress had done an analysis recently of over 7,000 zip codes, and they described half of them as childcare deserts. So it's this is not an urban problem. It's not an elite problem. It is really, for working parents, I think, a very pervasive problem in many, many, many places. If not the majority of places, it's hard to get your arms around like the true comprehensive national picture, but it has come into very sharp relief that that it is a large scale problem for many, many working parents in this country.
What is the definition of a childcare desert?
Well, I think you'd have to go to the Center for American Progress to get the sort of precise definition that they used. And it's, my reporting was about a year ago, so I can't give you sort of at my fingertips the definition that they used. But I think it's just a scenario where you are, where parents are very often finding wait lists and are not getting in anywhere in a timely fashion for when they need to go back to work. There's just not supply available to accommodate the needs of working parents in that community.
So let's get into the answer to the question of why there isn't that supply available given all the demand, your economics 101 question you mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
It sounds like the regulations on daycares, especially when daycares serving parents and children, very, very small children, make it just not profitable.
Well, so I and certainly I didn't do like an exhaustive like research study. This was a journalistic endeavor, and I talked to as many people as I could. But in I talked to childcare providers sort of at all ranges, at sort of your smaller local, and this was all over the country. I talked to sort of like independent providers, small chains, and then like your mega chains. And what I heard was, because this is certainly an argument that's out there, and I think there is something to it. You certainly hear a lot of it from conservative think tanks who say, like many sectors, the regulations are really gumming up the works. We are overregulating this sector, and it's inhibiting growth. It is too costly, too burdensome. And that sounds like a pretty persuasive argument. But when I talk to care providers, like I said, there's a kernel of that there. That what I heard, sort of, if I could give you a generalization of what I heard from care providers, was there are some regulations, and this, of course, varies from state to state. Different places have different regulations, but sort of the generalization of what I heard was, you know, there are some regulations that are burdensome, that are irritating, that don't feel so necessary. Things like, we have to sort of do the work of the state to collect like vaccination records, and it just seems like an unnecessary task for us. It's too burdensome for our staff. But the real like big costly regulation, like your top line thing, typically relates to staffing. It's a requirement that you have X number of adults, say, for example, a state, and of course this varies from state to state, it might be for infants from like 3 to 9 months, say, you need to have one adult caretaker for every 3 or 4 infants. And what I heard from care providers was, that's a regulation we understand, and we think that is a very, very costly regulation. But if you took that away and you tried to do without it, it could potentially create a dangerous environment. We understand why those regulations were there. So I didn't see a real burning desire on the part of care providers to, like, wholesale rip out regulations. They seemed to sort of understand why this structure was in place.
Right. Like, no, most people wouldn't say that one adult can care for an unlimited number of infants.
Right. And staffing for these centers really seems to be far and away the biggest cost. And so what I found was, when you sort of tally up, these are, and again, I'm not like a think tank with a huge research department. I'm one journalist who talked to as many people as I can. And the picture I came away with was, this is just a very challenging sector to operate in as a business. And I hope you'll hear from maybe there's some care providers out there who can call in and illuminate this for us further.
I would love to hear from them.
But so what I heard was, it's a very, very expensive business to run. You have, like I mentioned, staffing. You have to have a lot of staff to care for infants, to keep them safe. Your ratio needs to be quite low. You have staffing. You have insurance. You have all the brick and mortar costs of a regular business. And then some, because you have regulations that you need to meet. You need to have a safe environment. You need to have sinks and rooms and XYZ things. There's just a lot of things you need to do to keep these safe environments, well-staffed environments. It's tremendously expensive. And then when you, so for an ordinary business, you say, our costs are high, we just hike our prices and it balances out. That's, you know, market economics. And here you have, you really have sort of a ceiling that you hit with what you can charge, because at some point the parents in your community make a calculation, this is getting too unwieldy, this cost is too high, it's no longer worthwhile for me to stay in the workforce. It's less expensive for me to just quit my job and stay home as a caregiver. So these care providers do seem to be bumping up against a ceiling of what people are willing to pay. So their costs are very high. They can only charge so much. And it creates this environment, from what I was able to decipher, where you have just really razor thin margins. And this, there's really just not a lot of wiggle room. We hear there's this storyline that once you sort of dig into this area, you hear a lot about, which is child care providers, the teachers in these classrooms who are doing such critical work caring for these infants, for our children, they're making close to poverty wages. Many, many of them are on public support or on food stamps, because these centers, it's not, in my understanding and my reporting, out of cruelty or stinginess. It's just that they are operating on such thin margins, they can't pay much higher wages. So what I came away with was a picture of a very tenuous, very precarious sector, and a very high
liability
one. From a
business standpoint.
From a business standpoint, it's just not a very profitable field to be in. And then you throw in the liability. You're caring for very vulnerable children, and you have like one incident, which is very easy to have with these young kids, and like that could potentially put you under. So it's not a very robust, strong sector with well positioned to grow. And another factor that I found was which was just like a gut punch for me when it came to the realization, just having been on the receiving end of those horrific wait lists, and just how desperate you feel when you're number like 300 and just no prospect of getting in.
Yeah, I'm like, what am I going to do?
These businesses really need those wait lists. They don't have a great interest in seeing them evaporate, because they need to have a steady supply, because one unfilled spot, again, it goes back to those razor thin margins, one unfilled spot could be a huge financial hit. So they need to have a ready list of people they can burn through to fill a spot. So that wait list is sort of there by necessity for them as a business owner. But for parents, it's like every name on that wait list is a human being who needs a safe place for their child in order to be a productive member of the workforce.
So I have a question. Like, if supply and demand isn't fixing this, then the other sort of model would be to treat something as a public good, sort of like we've done with education.
Right.
At least an education option, starting with kindergarten and going up through grade 12. Do people ever talk about that as an option for daycare for the years before kindergarten?
Well, I think that is a, given where we are now in our political discourse, I would say that is like such a progressive idea that I would say probably pretty out in left field given the dialogue now. But I will say this issue, I think it's because it has been not very well covered up to this point. But I think as public recognition of this issue grows, perhaps that will become a less outlandish idea. I don't know. But I will say Ivanka Trump really raised the profile of issues around childcare. Donald Trump, at one point in his campaign, had something like 4 or 5 issue areas on his website, and childcare was one of them. Maybe I'm underselling the number, but it was a small number of issue areas. I mean, and I think that's really Ivanka's doing. She has been very focused on issues of working parents, and I don't know what her specific ideas are and what she's working on behind the scenes, but I think as the profile of this issue grows, you know, thanks to her, thanks to people like Kirsten Gillibrand, Senator Gillibrand from New York, and others who really have taken up the mantle of this issue. It's sort of like year by year gaining traction, and perhaps one day, like, there will be more concrete ideas for how to solve this problem. But I will say, like, I didn't find, like, really substantive policy ideas that are being debated. I think we're still in the phase of this story where the public is kind of getting its arms around it because working parents are sort of increasingly realizing how challenging it is.
Looking at models from the private sector, you write and report about a model with the Bright Horizons uses, and mm-hmm. that is interesting to me. Can you explain that?
Yeah. So when I was reporting, I was looking at this sector that, like I've mentioned, is sort of this frail sector, apt to fail. You see a lot of businesses that are short-lived, don't stick around very long, they go under, they aren't able to grow. And then sort of in sharp contrast to that, you see this behemoth, which is Bright Horizons. I don't know if you have it there in Kansas City.
But yeah, we do.
So we have it also here in Washington. It's a national chain. They're all over the country. I don't know if they're in every state, but they're definitely in most of them. It's a chain of childcare centers called Bright Horizons. They've been around for a long time, and they're growing like crazy. And their centers, I think when you go to most childcare centers, again, because they're working on these really thin margins, they're kind of depressing places. They're not like your cheerful, wonderful, like, I wish I was a baby so I could stay here. They're kind of like dingy. They're, you know, not the greatest facilities. But Bright Horizons, their centers, like not all of them, but a lot of them are beautiful. And they have well-trained teachers. They seem like these open, airy, modern places. They're really lovely. And I was like, how are they making this work when no one else seems to be able to do that? So I had an interview with their CEO, Dave Lissy. And so herein, I know from personal experience, again, when I was out on the hunt, I applied to get into quite a few Bright Horizon centers. And they charge very much the market rate here in D.C. I'm a little rusty on this, but I think it's certainly north of $2,000 a month, I think, for most of their facilities, which is what you get charged at most childcare centers. But Dave Lissy sort of spelled out their business model for me, and it all of a sudden made so much sense, which is Bright Horizons, and it also speaks to why I could not get in, is Bright Horizons operates very, very few just freestanding childcare centers. What their model overwhelmingly is they partner with an organization, whether just a company that has a lot of employees, sometimes not a lot of employees. Some of their smaller clients are like law firms or what have you, but their other corporate clients are, say, Starbucks, Home Depot, Chevron, and those companies partner. They contract with Bright Horizons to come in and build or operate a childcare center, and they sort of underwrite the childcare services. So Bright Horizons will come in at the request of, say, Starbucks corporate and build a childcare center near their headquarters. This is a sort of a probably using some artistic license here. with this example, but I do know Starbucks is a client. So they'll come in, they'll operate a center. And for every child in that center, Dave Lissy said, you know, the parents pay maybe $2,000 a month, but then the company is paying, I don't know, something like $1,000 above and beyond that to underwrite those services. So it sort of buoys Bright Horizons in a way where their margins are not so, so tight. They have this cushion, they can have nicer facilities, they can grow. So that subsidy that comes from the private sector, from the companies that partner with Bright Horizons, really seem to be the linchpin between a very fragile business model and a really robust, well-functioning one. And it just seemed to be like a very stark contrast. And so it speaks to this model where perhaps if you have a subsidy coming from somewhere, you're going to have more stable childcare, better paid teachers perhaps, cleaner environments, less likely to go under.
And for the company, employees with their kids nearby and mm-hmm. child care kind of figured out.
Who feel secure in where their child is with backup options. It allows them to be a more focused employee, a more productive employee.
You know, I just want to jump in before our time is up together. You know, you mentioned to a lot of parents dealing with child care scarcity, especially for really, really young kids. And I'm curious what kinds of stories, like recurring themes, emerged from those conversations.
I mean, it gets grim. I mean, because, again, we're talking about this is, at the end of the day, we're talking about care for the most vulnerable human beings. These are babies who cannot vocalize what they need, what has happened to them, they're just fragile human beings, and they need good care. And I talked to the months that I was reporting out this series and this piece in particular were some of my most challenging as a journalist and just as a human being, having a lot of empathy and sympathy, having been through this struggle myself. And when families cannot break into the formal sector, the licensed, supervised sector, they, if they want to stay in the workforce, they are redirected into what's
called
the gray market.
Want to or maybe have to.
Yeah. They're redirected into the gray market, which is unsupervised, unlicensed. You're really placing a lot of trust into somebody you probably don't know very well. You're not really equipped to vet. And I heard a lot of stories of children who had sustained. I mean, these incidents that are perhaps rare, but they're not that rare, of kids who are injured, kids who die. I mean, they're SIDS. It's not that it's not that hard for a baby to be in a scenario where they're really badly injured. So the piece that I did had a woman in California. She worked in biotech, still works in biotech in Fremont, California, who had a 4-month maternity leave, which is quite long if you look at the landscape of our country. And when she started looking for childcare fairly late in the game, but she still had months and months of maternity left. I think her child was about to be born or had just been born. Anyhow, she had at least 4 months lead time. And she told me she called more than 70 childcare centers. Three had availability. Two, she felt, were just messy, disorganized. She just could not bring herself to leave her child there. And the one that did have availability and that she felt like was her best option was an in-home facility that catered to toddlers. And the care provider there said, you know, no, we can handle a baby. It's not a big deal. And her baby died of SIDS on the very first day. Her baby was put down to sleep on his stomach, which goes against, you know, American Academy of Pediatrics recommendations, which is just a very questionable move for a child care provider to take. And it was, her child died. It was just a devastating story and a really heartbreaking one. And, you know, now that I've been attuned to this batch of issues and watch it, you'd see these stories not infrequently. And it's, there are, to me, this is a very much a life and death issue. And it's not something to be glanced over, because I think it has just really, really dire consequences.
Jessica Diehl, thank you so much for joining us from NPR.
Thank you for having me.
Jessica's story on the consequences of childhood scarcity for working families is online at npr.org. When KCUR's Central Standard returns, Kansas City parents, we want you to share your local stories and perspectives at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Back in a minute. Welcome back to KCUR Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. Call 816-235-2888 to join our conversation about the scramble to find daycare and how that affects your big life plans and decisions here in Kansas City. 816-235-2888. We're going to start hearing some of these stories about how this is personal, the real life ways that this plays out in our town. Shannon Carpenter is a Kansas City dad. He's been on the show before to talk about stay-at-home dadhood. Hi, Shannon.
Hi.
So you're a stay-at-home dad now. Had that always been your plan?
No, not at all. Actually, not until my son was about to be born. My daughter was in daycare for about a year and a half, and then my wife got pregnant. And about 3 months before my son was born, I decided, you know what, this just isn't working for us. So I quit my job. That's how it worked.
Take me back to those early days of, like, figuring out this whole daycare landscape.
Well, you call and you set up appointments and all that kind of thing that you do, and then you go in person to check these places out, and some you don't like. A lot you don't like, actually, not just some.
What kinds of things don't you like when you see a daycare?
High turnover from staff was a big one for me, asking the owner operator about that and if they would come back with an excuse or own it. Maybe the place didn't look that safe to me. I worked for the state of Texas investigating elder abuse before or during this time, so I had a lot of experience, you know, talking to people who were not exactly forthcoming, and so I'd pick up on that a lot. The ratio of child to parent or to teacher was a big deal to me. How attentive I thought they were, even when they were in the room. You walk in and maybe they're doing a toddler playtime and you have a toddler who's walked out of the room. I saw that several times, and actually went and grabbed one of them and said, hey, you lost a kid.
Oh.
And so after a year and a half of doing that and, you know, even finding our own place, that's when I was like, no, we're going to do it ourselves.
So, you know, this seems like a pretty big life decision to become a stay-at-home dad, and it's, we've talked about it before, it sounds like mm-hmm. a decision that you really enjoy, but is it partly like this issue of finding daycare that prompted it, or
yes.
Is it bigger?
No, it's part of that. I mean, there's 20 different reasons why I became a stay-at-home dad. The quality of the daycares that are around, the cost of the daycares versus how much money I was bringing in. At the time, I was like, I'm basically working to pay for someone else to take care of my kid, and then I get them for an hour and a half a day. That was it. You could pick them up, you come home, and that's it.
Yeah, they go to bed early.
Yeah, our kids went to bed about 7:30 at the time, and I get home at 6. So you don't have them for a very long time. But yeah, all of that factored into being the stay-at-home dad. And we went with an in-home care, as other people have. Rather than a facility, and not one is not as good as the other, and vice versa. You know, it's just kind of what you prefer.
There are at home places that are licensed, right?
Yes,
that's a distinction.
Yes, a licensed in home care versus an unlicensed, which we stay away from. You know, because you never know. You don't know, and I think that as a parent, that's the big question throughout the day. You don't know, and things happen, and it's very terrifying.
It's hard to imagine trying to work and not feeling very confident in this situation.
Yes, it's very hard. So I decided a lot more than my wife. She was kind of shocked when I volunteered. But yeah, that way I would stay home.
Okay, let's talk to one of our callers at 816-235-2888, Johnny and Lee Summit. What's your story?
Good morning.
Hi.
My wife and I decided to switch things up after we had our second, and they were about 19 months apart. And we pulled our youngest out of child care and got a nanny so that we got to kind of pick and choose. And it worked out unbelievably well.
You know, I mean, that sounds reasonable and everything, but what both you and Shannon are telling us about, it seems like financially a nanny is not something that everyone would necessarily have as an option. Or did you find that it made financial sense too?
It did both. So we kind of combined it. The nanny needed something that was a little bit flexible on a schedule. And so we found and interviewed dozens. And once it all got settled out, we found a nanny that was, I think, 21, 22 years old, who was still doing some college classes. So it allowed us some flexibility. And then she basically watched the children in the day, showed up at our house. So it was basically in home. She was, you know, took care of all the kids, washed all the dishes, facilitated laundry. I mean, everything that needed to get done from the children from basically the morning until the evening, or early afternoon. And then when my wife came home, she got a chance to head off and still get some classes done. And it worked out well, so well that even today, both of my boys are 7 and 9, and my nanny still stops by to see them.
That's really sweet. When the daycare situation didn't seem like it was working out for you, was that partly related to the availability issue we've been talking about, or was it something else? Was it hard to get into, you know, the one you wanted? Or
we were talking about earlier on, you were talking about the cost and how infants are so much more expensive. And so being that they were 18 months or 19 months apart, give or take, they both fell into that infant level. So now we have essentially two infants in the daycare and super, super expensive. And then just breaking that cost down, we were thinking, well, let's look into. And then when we broke it all down, cost effectively, there wasn't a lot of difference between having two children or two infants in daycare than to having a actual physical provider in the home that we've got to pick. It's one-on-one, or essentially one-on-two. It's in our home, so we know that everything is safe. We got a chance to, like I said, interview 12 different individuals. When it all came down to it, couldn't have been happier. And the cost, not as great as what I really honestly thought. I thought it would be significantly more expensive, and in the end, not really a factor at all.
Maybe especially once you have a couple of kids and are adding up those tuition costs, because I've heard that people in a lot of cases pay more for infant care than, like, it's comparable with college tuition.
Very true.
Well, thank you, Johnny, for your call.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
You know, this dollars and cents issue does come into play, and I want to turn to one of our other guests, Seth Tomasi. Seth, take me back a little bit. We'll get back right back to our callers, but tell me what your life was like when you got ready to welcome a child into the world. What were you up to?
I was managing a Sprint wireless retail store, selling cell phones and managing a team, you know, 5 to 10 people. And my wife is a graphic designer, and she was working for Bolte Hall here in the area. And we had our first child and found a lovely in-home daycare, nice lady and her husband who did it, $215 a week. So we did that for about a year, and then we looked at the numbers and realized we wanted to have a second child, because one of the things my wife made me promise is that if we had one child, we would have two children. So looking at the numbers, for at $215 a week, then two children, that's $22,000 a year. That was, after taxes, slightly more than half of what I was bringing home every day. And so we decided financially it'd work out a lot better. And like Shannon said, not paying someone else, just going to work to pay someone else to raise my children.
Yeah.
You know, you come home, you eat dinner, you put the PJs on, and you go to bed. And that's, except for Saturday or Sunday, if you don't work a retail job, those are the days that you get the time, you know? And
what did that arrangement feel like to you when you were doing it?
You know, the hardest part is dropping your child off at someone else's house to be, you know, for the day. And my daughter got much better about it. She loved the woman who took care of her. And so it wasn't, you know, the first couple of weeks was really hard because they cry and scream and don't want you to go. And then it became actually harder on me because she was excited to see the daycare provider and wasn't, you know, was ready for daddy to be gone. You know, go away now. It's okay. I'm here where I belong. And that really kind of hurt a little bit. And you miss that. And so it was very difficult to spend more time with your coworkers than you do with your own children. You know, I finally had to stop asking the daycare provider to tell me when things had happened. I was like, I don't care if she did it first here. I would rather see it at home and say that's the first time she did something.
Oh, like milestones.
Right. The milestone steps. And you know, in this day and age, it's wonderful she would send cute little videos and stuff. But I want to see that the first time she's using a spoon by myself in person. You know, I don't want a video from daycare of her feeding herself oatmeal or things like that. And that made the decision to be a stay-at-home dad easier to see, though. You know, my daughter started walking, and I wanted to be around for the running and the jumping and the climbing. And
yeah.
So,
but for either of you to stay-at-home dads in the studio with me now, are there things about the careers you had been in before that you think about sort of wistfully, or that, you know, you imagine had there been like the perfect daycare option you might still want to pursue?
I miss the commute at times. I do. The quietness and listening to your own radio. I miss the adult interaction.
That's what I miss.
I think the biggest one.
Talking to other adults.
Yeah.
You don't realize until 90% of your conversation is with a 4-year-old all day long.
Yeah.
How much you miss talking to other grown-ups.
Speaking of options and availability, are there options that would provide like a split the difference kind of thing? Like, are there a lot of part-time daycare options available out there? Is that something?
There is actually, especially as you get older, going into preschool, you can do 2 days a week. I actually do that. I do two days a week for my 4-year-old to kind of get him ready for a classroom for kindergarten next year. And that's significantly cheaper. Some places offer half day, some places don't, or some don't offer any at all.
I'm Gina Kaufman, and Central Standard has to take one more short break. What's been your experience looking for daycare in Kansas City? Did a lack of options change your plans? Did you fear it might? How did everything turn out in the end? 816-235-2888. We'll be right back. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and we're talking about the surprise that awaits many new parents when they discovered how hard it is to find a spot with a really good, safe daycare provider, or one that they feel is good and safe based on what they can glean. If you can add affordable to that list, you're basically looking for a flying unicorn with magical powers. Erica Dolores Miller, good morning.
Good morning.
You are here with an additional guest in your arms.
I am. This is Nathan. He's 4 months old.
So tell me your story as you've like navigated this world we've been talking about, the world of the daycare options that are available and how to get one that makes you feel comfortable.
Wow. Well, you know, when you become a parent, I think that is one of the hardest decisions that you have to make is where is my kid going to go for 8 hours a day? You know, as a working parent, both my husband and I are working parents, and that was one of the hardest decisions we had to make. So, you know, just like some of the other guests have shared, it starts long before that kid is even born. Getting on waiting list, going and interviewing daycares, dropping in on daycares to see what they are all about, even when you don't have an appointment. There's so many different factors, including the cost.
Yeah. Take me to, you know, when you say that's the hardest decision or one of the hardest decisions you make, take me back to that decision and what it looked like for you.
Sure. Well, like I said, before our first daughter was born, I was lucky enough to talked to some other parents that had gone before me and what their decisions were, what their struggles were with finding childcare. And so with that knowledge, I was able to start ahead of time and get on waiting lists. And so that's what I did. We started with, I actually started with Googling daycares in the area, you know, and figuring out what daycares were in my area, and do I want to put my kid at a daycare that's close to my house or close to my job? So that was my starting point. And from that, I went and I called them to see if they had openings. Looking at the cost, and went and interviewed them, went and made appointments with those that I could, and went and visited. And for my husband and I, it was about kind of being able to drop in when we wanted to, just to see
how
things were.
An open door policy.
An open door policy, which some daycares don't like you to do. You know, they want you to set up an appointment and come in for a tour, which is great. But for me as a parent, I want to see what you're doing when nobody's looking, when you're not prepared for my visit. That's what I want to know.
So how many children do you have now?
We have three children.
And you've got one who's 4 months old, and you're headed, are you back at work again?
I'm not back at work yet. Well, I take that back. I am doing some independent contract work, which has allowed me the flexibility to stay at home with him at this point. But that is something that I'm going to have to think about in the near future. Where is he going to go? Who is he going to be with? How much is that going to cost?
Yeah. And you think you're going to... You think you're going to head down that daycare route again?
I think so. Again, I'm keeping my options open. I'm trying to figure out what's going to be the best for us right now. But the nice thing about the stretch between our kiddos is we have one in daycare and one out of daycare. So we're never having two kids at the same time in daycare, which is helpful for the pocketbook.
Well, let's turn back to our switchboard just to hear what other people in Kansas City are experiencing. Let's go now to Fulla. Hi, Fulla in Kansas City.
How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm awesome. Just sitting here getting ready to go into work. Decided to give you a call.
What's your story?
I was telling your producer, I'm listening to the comments, and it's exactly like everyone says. You know, the cost is exorbitant. And when you take in the fact for people who work a regular 9-to-5, you know, there are so many options for daycare. If you're able to afford it, if you get there in time, you know, you at least get your kid in somewhere. But, you know, my fiance and I are both restaurant workers. I work at a country club and she manages a pizza restaurant. So for parents who work off hours, you know, there's almost nothing, much less licensed, the government sponsored or, you know, company sponsored or anything like that. And that's quite a large population of Kansas City. You know, we have a huge hospitality industry over here.
What do you do about that?
Well, the way we worked it out is to work the off hours. So when I'm at work, she's at home. And when she's at home, I'm at work. And so...
So those requests to cover an extra shift, probably can do?
Well, with for planning, you know, we're able to explore babysitters. And you know, I heard a guest of yours talk about a nanny. And, you know, a light bulb went off in my head like, hey, we're spending so much in childcare. Here's an option. You know, we could start looking at that. So, and they also do a part-time daycare twice a week just to get them ready for school. My daughter's three. I have three kids. One is 9. She's in school already. And my other one's 3. And then my son is 2. So... they've just kind of crept out of that expensive range to where it's a little manageable, but we can still just realistically only afford to do part-time if we don't want to be, you know, just working to pay daycare.
Yeah. Thank you so much for that call, Fulla.
No problem. You have a nice day.
You too. Seth, you know, we were talking before, but this working off hours thing, do I understand that you do sometimes use some off hours employment to kind of supplement?
Yes, I work 3 nights, overnights a week. I work Thursday, Friday, Saturday night, frosting donuts. So that's the extra money for date nights. And so my daughter can be in gymnastics classes. And, you know, you can go on a vacation and not just pay the bills every month and put a little money away. But the thing of it is the last caller really raised an interesting point. For parents who aren't 9-to-5, who are in retail or hospitality or not just Monday through Friday jobs, a lot of times the alternating schedule cuts into that time for husbands and wives and husbands and husbands and wives and wives. And you don't really get to see your spouse as much as you'd like to because those...
Or do those all family activities.
Right, right. You don't get to have the family dinners because one of you is at work or sleeping because you're recovering from work. And it really... Parenting is about making sacrifices and about making choices. And for everyone, it's different. For me and my wife, the sacrifice was my career and staying home so that our children could grow up and we could not be quite so financially strapped. For other people, it's going to work and having to have their kids in daycare for 8 to 10 hours a day and only getting to see them for breakfast or dinner or Saturdays or Sundays or whatever. And... you know, you make the choices that are right for your family. It's just hard to have those choices taken away from you by the scarcity of daycare or by the cost of daycare or by the availability of hourly daycare that you need. You know, if you work the 10 p.m. to 6 a.m. shift.
Yeah, I figured out theoretically how to do it.
Right, right. In theory, this should work. But in practice, you call 14 or 15 different daycares trying to find someone in your price range that has availability when your baby's going to be born.
And the killer is getting on those wait lists isn't always free.
Right. Sometimes you have to pay to be on the wait list. So you've put $100 down at a place that you may never see.
Tell me how this has affected you. Like, you're nodding your head, Erica, and I'm just curious what you're thinking right now.
Well, it's just so difficult because you would hope that, you know, it's... when you have a baby, the one thing you want to do is stay at home with that baby. And I know earlier on the show, there was conversation about maternity leave or paternity leave and things like that. And that's something, it's just such a difficult thing to leave your child after you've had a baby. And I think that if it was easier to find affordable childcare and ones that were licensed, that were, you know, had the proper everything, you know, it'd make it a little bit easier, but it's a hard decision for families.
Yeah. I want to turn now quickly to Blair in Kansas City, Missouri. Blair, you I understand you've opened a child care business, and I'm, you know, we've talked earlier in the show about why more places don't step in to fill the demand that parents feel. Can you maybe offer some perspective on that? Is there something that people don't understand about what it's like to start a daycare?
Yeah. So I was actually also a consultant previous to this and helped people open up child care centers because what people don't understand is there's a lot of inspections you need to go through. So in Missouri, you actually have a fire inspection from the city and the state. Then you have a sanitation inspection. Then you have your main inspector who comes out. So each one of those departments walks through your building, finds little things, you know, that are wrong that you have to correct. I mean, things like there's chips up on the paint on the walls. There's scuff marks on the floor. There's a water spot on the ceiling tile that you haven't gotten the chance to replace just yet. Little things like that. And on my side of things, I feel it's really, really important that we have those inspectors, but it takes a long time. And it deters a lot of people from wanting to open up centers. You can go and sit down with these inspectors and have your plan meeting. And they'll give you a 2-page list of all the things you have to fix before you can even open. And that's more money. So a lot of people will start the process and then say, you know what, it's just not really worth it. But there is the other side of things, which is in Missouri, unfortunately, you can be an unlicensed center. So being an unlicensed center means that you can have children in your building. You do not have to follow the same regulations as a licensed child care center. The only stipulation is you have to care for grade schoolers. So you could offer a kindergarten program. but also have infants, toddlers, and preschoolers, and just not be licensed at all and have no one come and inspect you.
It sounds like
that's
you,
the thing I've noticed,
you,
that parents don't really ask.
The parents don't ask whether they're licensed?
Mm-hmm. That's
yeah.
a very important question that parents don't ask.
So it sounds like a good tip to ask if you're in Missouri whether your daycare is licensed. It sounds like our time is up. Thanks to everyone who called in or joined the conversation in any way. In studio, we've got Shannon Carpenter, Seth Tomasi, and Erica Dolores Miller. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
And you can listen back to this discussion at kcur.org/Central Standard tomorrow, the College Campus of the Future and Race in Kansas City's Nightlife. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tudhope, and Suzanne Hogan, with help from intern Tom Taylor. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.